26th January, speaking to Lisa Nelson in Café Beaubourg. Can you what you were saying about survival and concept, survival in the culture?
I don't know if I can reconstruct. I'm curious. When I was talking about concert dance and a kind of illusion, that we stand on a certain illusion that we agree to, consensus reality the culture offers us, a whole set of behaviors and a way to compose ourselves, to create this illusion of culture. What I was speaking about when I was speaking about, I was trying to articulate this negotiation that we're constantly making between our kind of reflexive underlying behaviors, movement patterns to collect information from the environment through each of our senses that we need for feeling safe in any environment, and part of the information we need to be safe is a way to kind of disappear into the cultural norm. And with this simple example of how we have to compose ourselves to have a conversation, that one I use a lot, to see and be seen at the same time, to appear to be listening at the same time as actually making the effort to be listening. And in the sense that if I want to really listen to you, it might be distracting for me to look at you. But that's not that acceptable, to not take the choreographic pattern of showing our attention to each other. And also that effort, of course I was making it desperately in this conference situation, the effort to get the thoughts from my head to my tongue, which is a very unnatural, somehow it's not, my animal isn't constructed that way for speech in an easy way. I don't express myself easily through speech. So I was offering the possibility that for me, if I really were to be able to survive the talking in this conference with this pattern of waiting and translating and trying to hold my train of thought, I would do much better to really slow down and move my face a lot, because it really helps me keep a train of thought. It gets in my body. So I was showing that way that would work much better for me, and actually it really straightened things out. For that sentence, I actually got to the end of that sentence and could remember it if they asked me, you know, to repeat it. This would not be easy if I used that technique that made me more integrated in the culture. It would be too distracting for people. So I will go along. I have to, you know, maintain, I have to learn how to negotiate that territory so that I don't distract, so I can go along with the assumption that the culture offers us to make some stability. And in making that analogy between looking at concert dance, what are we proposing? Where has the dancing gone? And how every dancer has to negotiate that territory between their motivation to dance and the proposals that are conventionally created, the proposals, stage audience or observer audience, that are existing in our cultures. And in many ways, looking at that consensus as the is absolutely essential to the survival of a population, and not to the survival and counterproductive for the survival of the individual. But the analogy is the same. We negotiate those things unconsciously all our lives. And my Ernst von Glossersfeld, my stepfather, the epistemologist and radical constructivist, who is adamantly, seems very purist, when he refers to how the brain, the person constructs, has to construct their, well, construct some sense of meaning and organization out of all of the sensorial array. And he insists that there is nothing out there.
Yes, there's nothing on nothing in as such.
Right, and so in being a physical person, living a very physical life in a very physical world, not just the world out there, but the world inside the body, the existence of matter, like my body is outside my brain, if I want to look at it that way, it's outside my thought, in the sense of thinking in language. So to deny that there is matter, that there's matter, is very counterproductive to learning how to survive in the world. He even used an example once, this might be not true, but this is what I understood, that that we also construct the ground we walk on, and that it's a cultural consensus reality. And without that consensus reality, of course, we'd be stumbling all over the place. If your foot can't assume that the ground is there under the next step, then actually we'd have to find another way to transport ourselves, maybe by beams or something, you know, science fiction beams. We would never walk, we'd just transport. But to the extent that I see that as, you know, we trust that the ground will stay underneath us until we perceive an edge, you know, the beginning of a step in our peripheral vision, that much I'll go along with, that we do. From what our senses give us, we establish some stability in the environment so that, but the idea that the culture establishes this consensus that the ground is there is a little bit of a leap for me. I mean, we establish what chairs are for, you know, and in any other culture we establish our seating, what sitting is. But that there isn't anything there, I don't know what it serves to think that. Well, anyway, it doesn't. I can't quite go that far. But in terms of human behavior, I can really embrace that thinking that I construct at every second through my experience.
Yeah.
Yeah. So in all the analogies that come from that, in terms of in this project in the last 2-3 weeks with 7 people who really came with open minds to into a process that out of the 7, only 2 had an idea of what that process might lead to. And part of the journey in looking at one's own patterns of behavior in entering a space or looking at a space and creating this communication tools is a breakdown of all your assumptions about what's there, your own constructed reality, because it's making a tiny little microcosm of that in a room, how you know where you are, establish what's stable in your environment, and in actuality, what's stable within you. You know, which assumptions you can hold on to when, and which are constantly challenged and the rug is pulled out from under you. Somewhere in the course of starting to understand the idea of tuning and listening, a kind of consensus starts to emerge just for survival's sake, and each person navigates that their own way, either by pushing the limit, or by a kind of more watchful a withdrawal. And it's such a complex process. Everybody's going, reaching into everything they know, but also watching themselves and deciding when to risk their own pattern based on their response to being interrupted in their pattern, because that's a very emotional thing at first, but there's a way you can tune into it from experiencing it or creating a trusting environment that it's not going to be questioned on a psychological level, that you're your own laboratory animal. That there's a kind of a decorum that evolves over, in cycles, a decorum where there's kind of someone makes a big push at the limits and everybody shuffles in how that changes their reality, and then becomes more polite. A new decorum gets established by a conversation about how each person perceived it or survived it, it's very fragile, that because this consensus, which then becomes a kind of decorum or politeness, keeps getting made and destroyed and unmade. And it was really a rich opportunity, this, with that many people. There were 7 of us, and with the language differences in discussion, because the language, my language is difficult, whether it's in English or not, because I really need to be precise, and to kind of define the territory so that it isn't a psychological encounter, but we acknowledge that that's, you know, going on also in our reports, but we have very specific events that we can unravel. So it keeps putting the image outside of ourselves and giving some time to kind of process one's own emotional responses to one's own behavior, because that's what becomes very, it becomes very apparent. If you have tools that you can use to interrupt the action, and also to ask for explanation, and you have to figure out when to use them, and sometimes you use them very naturally, reflexively, and it's very clear how to use them, but then you also use them because you're making theater, and so you provoke things to happen that aren't about caring for the psychology of anything. It's more about, it could just be a visual, a really shift into a visual excitement, and not be polite about also looking in through the surfaces. And so you're shifting from looking at the surface values and, you know, to into the human being. All that said, it's just that game is possible to play, but it's very fragile also, because it's possible because we agree it's possible. That's really the only reason why it's possible. Say, oh yes, I could look at you like a diamond reflecting light, or I could look at you like a little piece of, you know, garbage in the corner of the room, and be stimulated enormously by that. And if I'm the little piece of garbage, I could be delighted by that image. It frees me from being me, all kind of trapped and paralyzed in the corner. If I keep shifting what sense I'm looking through when I'm inside, it gives me a way to act. It gives me other possibilities of action. If I don't trap myself in my own image.
Yeah.
So in that very short time, all of that really got activated. And so in the runs, whatever run we would do, they really had a kind of exponential, nothing was repeated. We never got to the point where we could say this run was, reminded me of the run we did a couple of days ago where this came up, because it just was still so new. The name of the movie was always, it was always a different name. So we hadn't gotten long enough to create history on that level. And also we weren't watching the videos very much at all to be able to corroborate our understandings of a moment where something might come together. So I, just because I was thinking about this consensus thing, what happened working with 23 people in, or, you know, 18 or 23 in Brussels, which was so horrifying to me because of my fears and ineptitude with groups of people, was instinctually with that size group, a lot of the animal instincts of surviving the group were very, you know, sharp. And so certain aspects of listening were just essential for survival, like for really not bumping into each other. So there was an agreement and a consensus reality that of being a large group that kind of supported making this journey into individuals looking at what we were doing in their own way, but also participating, offering their beings or their bodies to be part of this image to each other. And at the end of the second workshop, I was amazed all the way through that the system wasn't breaking down, that the illusion that this communication system could work in a kind of artistic practice hadn't broken down much earlier, because it was so frightening to me. And it broke down all at once in one of the showings, the second of three showings, right, it just went to total shit. It was just all the stupid shit that would normally arise during the workshop, but had somehow been kept back by some other illusion of what we were working on, which was very exciting, kind of artistically, the holding back of all that stuff. But it all came out at once, and everybody was lost at once, you know, except for the few people who were acting out this, you know, kind of ego shit. They had no idea that everybody else was just paralyzed with fear. And I think we weren't using a restart call in that group, so, but yeah, we hadn't used it yet. It would have been a very useful thing in that, but anyway, it was, and then we had the aftermath of that, which was like a big funeral. Like, everybody was disillusioned the next day, really deflated by that experience. I was not deflated, I just had no idea what to do, because I expected it to have happened along the whole way, and it wasn't. It's just kind of waiting, you know, not even really praying that it wouldn't, because it seemed like it couldn't not happen. Or if it did happen, it would be bad luck that it happened, that it didn't break down. You know, bad luck for us that we couldn't acknowledge that it was very fragile what we were holding up as a group.
A very wrong idea.
An unreal idea.
It hadn't broken down.
Right, in that way.
Also, the way people take it into their own work further, yeah. It wouldn't have been such a good message.
No, it wouldn't.
So it's,
yeah, it really needed to happen.
Yeah.
And anyway, everybody recognized it after. And then I thought, oh shit, we have to do one more. And the last one was beautiful. I mean, the reason for listening was reaffirmed.
Yeah.
But to really get some really powerful theater out of that large group, you know, pushing the limits would be necessary. But I could recognize in this smaller group how time-based, how really you can't push it. It just really has to, I pushed a lot to introduce more things. I mean, I pushed against my instinct for the learning process.
The way you can let it unfold.
Yeah, and spend more time working on one call or investigating one call or one situation. Yeah, I just was pushing it all the way. But also because I chose those people feeling like they had a mature process, and I had no idea how, you know, how specific the learning process would be, how time-based. I always think it's very time-based, because I'm still trying to learn it, and it's been, you know, really a good 15 years of practicing the score in its present incarnation, you know, and still feeling like I could go much slower. But it still was, because of the people, there was, in practice, a lot of things were not proven, but in extrapolating, you know, through scenes, some of the possibilities. People were very brave. That's all I could say. Really brave, because it, but also that was accepting, knowing there was performance and everybody knows what they need to do to do that.
The survival, another thing, the survival line is that because I know a little bit part of your life, right, I start more and more seeing that you really had to make this work.
It's a survival. Yeah. It was completely a survival strategy.
And for different, maybe for different priorities at different times, maybe it might, may have started with a concern for I remember that you sometimes refer to yourself as like coming from another planet, trying to understand what communication is.
Yeah, absolutely. And speech.
And speech is. So that's like the first micro, the microcosm serves that.
Yeah.
But like now, in your later life, you speak about your concern for losing the bit of memory. And so again, you can see that the tuning score actually could be wonderful microcosm for that too.
Right, or, oh yeah. But starting with invisible forms, because
that's for you.
Yeah, I think we talked about this before. Maybe did we? My kind of rundown. That was a question yesterday about invisibility. But anyway, in so many ways, I started calling my workshops, my laboratories, they were for, I guess from the, I guess maybe 80, from 1980 on it, I called them, it was called Invisible Forms. That was my, my workshops I called Invisible Forms. And well, this comes from learning how to see, from to use my visual sense through video. I'm not going to go into that story, but I'm just going to refer to it. But in my two least developed, the two senses, the two sense organs that I was least developed for me were vision and trying to figure out a way how to call speech a sense of speech, but I can't. But two things that were very underdeveloped, I would just say things here, were vision and...
First one surprised me.
Well, you know, I was visually oriented in the sense that I think I was alone a lot as a child. I spent a lot of time with myself. And I didn't play with myself a lot of visual games. I drew, you know, I did things. I made visual things, but I didn't play with my visual sense very much. I don't remember staring at things, you know. I don't remember playing with organization of things. I didn't know how to look at painting. I don't remember being that visually oriented. I lived in my ears and in my body. I was musical. I danced. I also drew and I wrote, and you know, and my mother was a sculptor, but she kept that very much in the corner. But she made things with her hands. I mean, the sculpture was She worked in clay. So, and she was very visual. But anyway, I wasn't. I also was not, speaking was just a very, very distant thing. My father, when he died, when I was 11, he just disappeared. And besides that, the literal invisibility of him suddenly becoming invisible, culturally, because his body was never found, there was absolutely no other way of making visible his absence, you know, in some way. So I really put a lot of time in, yeah. In very quietly all alone to try and, as a kid does, to try and make sense out of that invisibilization.
Yeah.
And then when I was 30 and I was naming my work Invisible Forms, having come through the experience with learning how to, I really learned about all my other senses through doing video, because it was my least dominant, my least, I really had to learn how to see with my eyes. That pattern, all the patterns, survival patterns I built for dealing with this invisible thing, make a very clear line all the way through my discovery through video of vision and what is more, what's in front of us. Like, when my father died, what was in front of me disappeared. Not just his body, but my future. Because with losing one parent, the fear of losing the second is so in front of you. Your future is the possibility of having no parents and being lost in the world. So there were a lot of parts of my environment that threw me into this future with a big gap in it, this invisible thing. So I would say I put a lot of time into it consciously as a child, this puzzle, and all the, because it was an inner life working out, and also observing how things happened outside constantly to find out where I could withdraw. I'm social, and I was a very shy person, so I had a terrible shy problem. So I did observe.
Yeah.
But I observed behavior, I didn't observe visually. That's another way of not being visual.
Yeah.
I mean, I would watch people talking endlessly, trying to figure out the patterns of behavior, so I just couldn't understand the conversation, what kept it going. So these skills, these building up of skills, kept kind of leading me towards finally dealing with the aesthetic questions, because of creating work, that people found untrustworthy because it wasn't visually repeatable. No, visually repeatable. I mean, I would do the same dance, but it didn't have the same movements, and people couldn't, anyway, it was untrustworthy, but for me, it certainly was trustworthy. I saw it. And it started to make visible to me what was possible to find in work of that sort, which was detailed physical movement on more or less invisible things, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But seemed quite imagistic to me, not conceptual at all. I mean, you know, playing with ideas, I could never start from that, but I would try and frame what I did to make it more visible, the values more visible, but never starting from or reorganizing based on an idea. Not feeling like I have any ideas. I don't like ideas all that much presented to me in theater. I've just never been very interested in it because I like to discover myself, what's there, but and surviving teaching.
That's another,
yeah, that
another
was
one.
A giant thing that happened when I was much, very young, that I had to start teaching.
All coming together in this.
Yeah, they were, it was very linear, actually, in a way. It just kept layering how to solve my life problems and find a way to practice making things.
I see. I mean, I always think of the story of your father, because for me it's formative.
Yeah.
So I had that in mind, also thinking of how you construct your survival techniques, and that your work is basically now, as we can, you know, we go to the theater yesterday, we see the sum of different survival techniques that came into your life at different points, but this formative moment is...
It's
a father.
It's an establishing. It wasn't really that he was not there, it was that he disappeared. Yeah.
And what makes me, where sometimes for me it becomes emotional is that the irreversibility of time. And it's the irreversibility of time that you see displayed all the time. Like, even the reverse calls can only make that even more clear, how irreversible it is. And it's like you, film can give us a little bit the illusion that something can tumble down into real chaos, and you can rewind it, and it's perfect again. But we don't, in our lives, we have entropy. And entropy is just the irreversibility of time, that things cannot...
Although this is what's coming more, also appears in the attempt or the effort to reverse, is just the most remarkable thing, because, okay, on that level, the irreversibility of time, things won't meet. The random synchronicities that happen in life, in terms of reversibility, well, there's reversibility and double reversibility. So, like, you know, the building falling down and then falling back up and meeting again. All the meetings happening on time. In going backwards, reversing physically, the meeting, it's, you actually can go back. It's just that all of the synchronicities have shifted. They've shifted it. They've phased it. They've gotten out of phase. And then you're in the present because you're in your body experiencing your reversal. But the past will suddenly register like a crystal. These landmarks will suddenly become visible. And also, perhaps you reversed a handshake and then tried, with your eyes closed, reversed the handshake and did the same motion as close as you could, reversed it again. The hands might not meet, but at that point where they would have met, the other person's hand is really, you experience the other person's hand in your hand.
Yeah.
And it, And so this is where the imagination gets very rich, and what memory, the imagination, the equation of memory, and but also off, you're bumping into your future when you reverse, because you're traveling towards, you're in real time, so you're traveling towards a future, a new future. What it does is it makes this kind of, I'm sure they have a name for this in physics, but I don't know what it is. And it's sort of holographic in some way, that the future and the present moment and the past are completely in new places. I don't know, I think about the irreversibility of time, because when, let's say, you return to a memory of your childhood, and over time the sensorial, the richness of the sensorial events during that moment have maybe faded away, so you can't quite build the picture with as many senses as you might have had. Yeah, some of them kind of go, fade out completely, but you still have something. I just realized something interesting. It's just a made-up thing, but the thing about the father, when he disappeared, my future disappeared. As a child, I mean, I was just absolutely lost. There was no... fear of the consequences in a real way, but also somehow the stability of the parents are your future. They're what you depend on for your survival. And then at the other end of my parents' lifespan, my mother's lifespan, she's losing her memory. And so there's, and also with my own experience of having very bad short-term memory loss a couple of years ago, and having been practicing the score so much over in these intervening years, my difficulties with memory show up just as strongly while playing the score as they do, you know, in my daily life. And as I watch the totally unpredictable pattern of my mother's memory loss, it thrills me, the unpredictability of it. It doesn't seem to have any patterns, you know, what she loses and what she regains and then what she remembers. At this phase, it's an interesting phase of her memory loss. It's gotten so complex, and also she's gotten more comfortable with it. So, you know, it becomes more like theater in the sense that it's a theater, real big theater of operations, and we can comment on it.
Every dysfunction is a new function.
Yeah. And so, yeah, so she goes through the dysfunctional frustration into building new coping mechanisms, and it goes on like that, and the new coping mechanisms are sometimes very creative. I mean, they're all very creative, but I mean, sometimes they're very imaginative in an interesting way. But anyway, I was seeing this past and future meeting places where they get out of phase, and sometimes in the working of this score, the future is implicated very early on in the score, and it gets recalled. Something that's happened gets recalled in an unpredictable way.
Very early, could you be just more specific?
Early, and maybe if you were...
Early when you started doing it, or early when you just put it like this again?
Like if you're working for an hour.
Yeah.
Early in the run.
Okay.
Just to be a smaller example, early in the run something might occur that nobody somehow remarked on or acknowledged within, that somehow everything crystallizes around that set of relationships at the end, with nobody's awareness, and so the future being implicated. It's the same moment occurs again, but with so many other layers of acknowledgement, whereas nobody noticed it in the, noticed this event in the, consciously noticed this event. This kind of divining sand painting aspect of playing with the tuning score materials, it does seem like a bit of a microcosm of living, of a lifetime. In experience and working with the score over a long period of time, I just see more and more examples of how time within our experience, Scott and I have worked together a lot, and what happens now is we recall things, situations that arose in the learning process, specific things about certain calls and how they were interpreted or played out, you know, 10 years ago in a specific room, in a specific instance. And we can even bring them into the space at the moment, and we will recognize them.
It's very helpful because everyone has maybe a tense that's more dominant, and my very dominant sense in my life is past. So so probably that's why I also bring this very much to your work. I mean, I see that element very pronounced, and because I'm already like preformed to hold on to that maybe more. And it's only recent that I started having a much more complex understanding of how the different tenses cooperate in the score, and much more thinking about how future is always implicated or activated. There's a lot of prediction going on in the score. I mean, all predictions.
All predictions.
So I will listen to what you said, because I don't know. I mean, time is very different for me as soon as I bring in the other tenses. So when you speak about really like the past meeting the future, it gets very, I kind of lose track.
Yeah, at the present, reverse is a fantastic exercise for seeing how you retain the present while you're moving into the past. If we were looking at something together, I could say that's a good example, but that's an example of how there's also, in order to move, you have to prepare action, not consciously, but the body prepares action. So there's always a looking, a predicting into the future. There's no way for the body to move without that, without projecting it, either in the imagination and also the body organizing itself.
You have made very nice comments on how Bonnie Cohen works with that and is trying to, you know, with her work with brain injury children.
Yeah. And I think that the scientific measure of that time of the motor pattern getting organized in the brain is 1/100th of a second before the action is. It's written down, I can never remember, but they've measured it. They can measure that.
Overall, we've been talking about the analogies with survival in life and how that also the analogies with work and this implication. I have a very practical question, but how can I use some of that autobiographical information when I write about the work?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Because
absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's practical, but. Because, yeah, that's...
Yes, it's... Yeah.
Yeah.
Any of it works to make it apparent.
And the second question is, because we speak about analogies with your life, but also analogies how culture works and, you know, how this little microcosm works with similar codings and recodings, and it's like, but still I feel that the little microcosm that you establish or you present has an utopian aspect which we don't have in our culture. So I would ask you, like, in what way can we leave the analogy a little bit as it is and see where there's like a transformational aspect. It's not only doubling something as it occurs in our culture, but something that also like seems to open a little bit other perspectives in that way. You know,
I do. I mean, I. It's funny because it just Denise Lucioni came up with this comment about utopia that I asked her to write down, but I didn't. It was complicated. Yeah. I didn't quite understand it, and so it's just come up in the last.
Maybe utopian. I don't want to stick too much to the word, but
no.
There's something.
Well, I.
Constructive in that way too. It's not only reconstructive. There's something. Yeah.
Well, as a system of communication in a group, which is a little mini microcosmic culture, the idea that everybody has personal responsibility for their own desire to make it apparent is a ridiculous notion of a democratic kind of notion, but it's the empowerment of oneself. If you don't like it, change it. You know, it's like, if you don't like it, it's up to you. No, but you don't ask somebody else to do it for you. This is another survival thing for me, because I don't like groups and I've never been able to be in groups. And my life has led me to having to be in groups, communes, and never to my, always with great reluctance. And so I've tried to learn how to survive being in a group, very painstakingly. And so this communication system kind of evolved as a way, also making a performance, making art. I've never wanted to tell anybody what to do. And in teaching, I've never wanted to tell anybody what to do. So I've created an illusion for myself that I can make proposals for the sake of having somebody say, let's do this. And anyway, I had to do that to make my living, so I had to find a way to do it where I didn't feel like I was telling people what to do. And in order to work with a group, I had to find a way where everybody was directing. This just sort of fell out of this group tuning situation. Knowing all along that there were two things that were necessary. The difference between tuning and directing, for example, is so... It's so fragile, the difference between tuning something in. To offer oneself to somebody else's vision, aesthetic taste and vision, which has been very hard for me to do ever, to be the subject of... to recompose myself, to be willing to do that, I had to feel depersonalized. I had to get myself out of the way in a way that probably other people find very easy, but I find very difficult. To serve something else, to serve an image rather than to serve personal desire. So to first find out how to co-direct in a way that isn't directing but is tuning, is asking the individual to become somewhat empty of their selves, of their ego selves, and be willing to be seen, and willing to say, okay, I'll go along with this for a minute, but recognize that I'm going along with it. You know, if someone says to me, pause, I know they don't have to pause. How can I create the situation where they'd want to pause, or where I'd want to pause, because I've been given that request, suggestion, a clear indication that that would be a good thing to do at this moment. The fragility of both taking full responsibility for embodying one's, for inhabiting one's body, showing oneself at the same time, and being seen, and being encouraged to be seen more in relation to a whole picture, not in relation to oneself necessarily. There's a lot of levels of transformation in yourself. You have to do something. You have to do a lot of operations to survive that. It encourages a very, very awake dialogue with yourself in that situation, you know, to lend yourself to that experiment. And it also says, I take responsibility for following as well as leading. All of that is just so idealistic, I find. I'm not talking about utopia, but an idealized way of living in a culture. Also knowing, taking responsibility to say no. And it brings up all of the things that are impossible to figure out about how to stop our governments from doing the things that they're doing that we just absolutely don't agree with, and that they're doing it in our name. I mean, it's trying to find out how to empower oneself to see the shit that's on your plate, and in very local ways, you know, in your own house. Yeah, to recognize when the mess is a layer that's useful, and when the mess is a layer that's, you know, really creating an inertia that's hurtful, somehow hurtful to your own being at that moment. And then looking at time, how time flows, and how long it takes both for something to become visible, for the organization of that shit to become visible, so that you can take an action. And when you have to be impulsive and take a big risk. I was just talking to Michelle, who's thinking, he's involved with the Human Shield action that's being planned or discussed. We're going to Iraq, and although that's an action that's being made by many people, it's being discussed and shared by many people, and the risk is really, I mean, if you're looking at it, you know, based on past experience, it really is a risk. I mean, that you might get hurt or killed, so it's, you know, a commitment to not knowing consequences. Those kinds of risks people take all over the world all the time, but many of us don't have to, you know, in that.
Go there.
Yeah, we don't have to go there. It's not right in front of our face that we have to decide anything about it. somehow I think that's also this kind of practice, performance practice. I have, you know, an ideal about how I can make these things apparent.
Did you ever come close to it?
There have been runs that have been incredible in the studios. That have been just startling models.
Are you thinking, can you recall some moments or feel like why you felt that it got close?
I have to really think it through. It's very much more that it verges towards that at times, but I have to think of a good example. Actually, there are a lot of small... It's again, for me, bringing the small, the peripheral, the unintended, the non-centralized actions, the ones that aren't in the center of the attention, to attention. And then happens in little ways all throughout. Actually, we had a beautiful run yesterday afternoon where I felt like, I mean, it's also my aesthetic taste, that it matched, where the reading of time and attention in the group was made these beautiful dances. Very weird. And kind of not mechanistic at all, but so beautiful. Oh my God. This doesn't have to go up to me. But there was a scene that appeared that got tuned in from all kinds of reverses and replaces, and a lot of replaces. But this scene where three people were standing in a line parallel to the front of the stage, three people in a line, and it was a series of replaces. I left them there and in motion, and it was Vera and Nuno, and I think Levance, and each of them was doing different kinds of movement, but it was sustained, and there was some sound also that was involved. And the three worlds were just magnificent, three, but a beautifully simple organization, just that three, here are three worlds. And then Pascal and Drew. Ah, suddenly Vera took off her shirt. It was slow. I mean, it was, you know, normal pace. She took off her shirt. At the same time she was doing that, Pascal had entered from across the way, and he came directly towards her. She was the closest to him. And as she was making her, she made a baby bundle, and she was holding the baby, and Pascal suddenly appeared, and she just shifted her weight in a way that made a couple with a new baby. Somehow Pascal was interacting with her in some way. Suddenly she needed to put this baby bundle down. And Nuno was next still. Everybody stayed where they were. This was the beauty of it. And Nuno was leaning over, not paying any direct attention. And it was right there, and Vera took her bundle, her baby bundle, and she put it on the table. It was like a table. She just put it on the table in such a simple way, and left her baby there to be with her husband or whatever, her lover, Pascal. Laurence was in some other wonderful place, sightless. It was just exquisite. Anyway, it was a long time, and it just kept evolving without with giant changes that were very small. It was very
that's a description of a very beautiful scene. You know, it's a beautiful...
That's what I mean. It was just beautiful.
Yeah.
It was something that arose.
Yeah.
Just beautiful. And, you know, that could have happened by just three people going into the space and starting something, but it didn't happen that way. It evolved out of a lot of tuning. And it was a
field of cooperation.
Cooperations. Yeah, so anyway, the contradiction between cooperation and directing and personal responsibility, that I found very idealistic and utopian. And going from hive mind, you know, the three levels, hive, and then community, and then individuality, is very much, you know, in evidence in the process.
It's incredible. It's like an allegory for it also, because you have a group, they're also distinct, but they form a group, there's this baby unit, you know, there's the family, it's like...
Like the individuals start to melt away and form this kind of consensus community, and all the individuality goes away because you're going through a phase of trying to unite in some way with some common motive, and then over time the need for action evolves that's individually imagined, because the group can't do that kind of projection. But then reading about Aboriginal mind and the extraordinary way they communicate through time and space is a whole other thrilling adventure of looking at a very sophisticated development of human communication with very few people in an enormous space, through all covering thousands and thousands of miles distance.
I would call this a very good example.